It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Salahuddin was elected a little more than a year ago to serve on the Pittsburgh School Board. The post is just his latest in a career of public service and activism that has lasted more than five decades. Salahuddin, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin.
Salah, you were born in Pittsburgh, but you left with a few friends when you were, I believe, 16 for New York, where you wound up living with your aunt. In Pittsburgh, I mean, you were a poor African-American kid from the projects. Do you think that would have had you would have had that life of civil rights activism, of public service, if you hadn't left Pittsburgh?
I shudder to think what my life would have been like if I hadn't left Pittsburgh. When I got to New York and was taken in by my aunt off the streets of Harlem, she saved my life, and it exposed me to a whole new group of friends. It got me back in high school where I had dropped out. And my experience in New York high school is what got me exposed to the NAACP Youth Council, eventually a trip in 1963 to Washington to witness live the I Have a Dream speech by Dr. King. All of that changed my life, and it wouldn't have happened had I not initially left Pittsburgh and ended up in New York.
You organized a couple busloads of young people to go to Washington for the March on Washington. So how did hearing Dr. King's speech, you know, change the direction of your life? Because it did, didn't it?
I was 19 years old. And I guess all 19-year-olders are trying to figure out who they are and what they're going to be, who they're going to be, what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. I hadn't any answers to those questions. But when I heard Dr. King deliver that speech, I Have a Dream, that answered my question. And I decided then I want to join his army. I want to connect with him. And that's what I eventually did.
So you were recruited as a civil rights worker for the segregated South. You were recruited to go to Mississippi as a civil rights worker. I mean, both your mother and father were born in Mississippi?
No,
my father
was born in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Okay. My mother was born in Savannah, Georgia.
Okay.
But they knew
the dangers of segregation.
They absolutely knew the dangers. There wasn't much difference between Mississippi and Georgia. Mm-hmm. And they tried to talk me out of it. They thought my mouth was too big and that I was too arrogant and that I was going to certainly get in trouble because I didn't know how to talk to white folks. Mm-hmm. And my mother was frightened to death of the idea of me going as a civil rights worker to the Mississippi Delta.
Mm-hmm. So what was your role as a civil rights worker? What was it that you were charged to do?
I was a part of a project that was being run by SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, MFDP, we called it. Mm-hmm. Fannie Lou Hamer was our leader. And we had a number of different projects. One was getting people registered to vote. That was the primary one. The other was desegregating the local school and desegregating public accommodations like the bus depot, the streetcar, all of the public accommodations were segregated, and our jobs were to challenge them, to force them to either put us under arrest or to change these segregated practices.
It didn't take you long to get a taste of that segregation, did it, once you arrived?
This very same night, the very same night I arrived, I got a very strong taste of Mississippi hospitality where I almost got killed.
Yeah, that was, you made, quote, the mistake of entering the front door of a diner, was it?
I entered the front door, asked for change so I could make a phone call and a cup of coffee, and the lady looked at me like I had two heads and told me to get around the back to the colored window and don't ever come through the front door again.
Mm. So what sort of tactics, practices did you and fellow activists use? Of course, there were the marches and the sit-ins, but were some of the other efforts to thwart segregation maybe more subtle?
Well, one of the most important political institutions in the Delta of Mississippi was the Farm Agricultural Board. The Agricultural Board controls how much cotton each farmer is allowed to grow. And it's a political institution. People are elected to the Farm Board. And the history had been that the Farm Board gave all of the prime land and the prime quantities to white farmers and gave black farmers the leftovers. Mm-hmm. But black people in the county I was in Holmes County, were 70% of the population, but they were only 5% of the electorate. And so our first task was to get people registered to vote in the Farm Board election, the Agricultural Board election, so that the allocation of acreage, cotton acreage, could be more democratically and fairly distributed among black farmers. That was the first thing we did.
You mentioned a moment ago about walking through the front door of that diner. Was the most serious, and let's call it transgression against segregation, when you gave a ride to another civil rights worker? The civil rights worker was white and white woman, and I believe sat in the front of the car.
Yes.
Was that the biggest, quote, transgression, end quote?
It's a huge one. The practice had been that a white woman in Mississippi would never allow herself to be caught in the front seat of a car that was being driven by a black man. Mm-hmm. If she was riding in the back, like driving Miss Daisy, mm-hmm. that's okay, but not in the front. And this woman I was riding had multiple sclerosis, and she needed to sit in the front. And we got stopped one night by the Mississippi Highway Patrol, and it turned out to be a devastating night for me. I got beat up pretty bad.
All right. In the, I believe it was the late 60s, you gave up your birth name, Samuel Howells. Why?
Well, it was a custom. Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar,
Lou Elsendorf.
Yeah. Many people were taking on black consciousness, black cultural consciousness, and a part of that cultural shift was shedding what we called our slave names and taking on names that were more consistent with African culture. And a mentor of mine gave me the name Salahuddin because it means one who seeks knowledge, which meant one who asked a whole lot of questions. And that name has stuck with me since then.
Okay. During the time you kept your ties with Pittsburgh, I believe many trips back and forth. On one such trip, I believe that's when you learned about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The man's speech in 1963 had inspired you. How did his murder affect you?
I was devastated. I was in a car taking Dr. Alvin Poussaint back to the airport. He had
here come, in Pittsburgh?
Yes, in mm-hmm. Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. He had come to speak to the Black Action Society at the University of Pittsburgh. And we were on the highway going back to the airport with the radio on when it was interrupted and the announcement made We both were close to the civil rights movement and adored Dr. King. I had to pull over to the side of the road and take in the news announcement that Dr. King had been killed. It was unbelievable.
Today would have been Reverend King's 90th birthday. Looking back, what lessons did you learn in your youth that you would give to today's young activists?
Perseverance is one. We've got to keep up the struggle, keep up the fight. We've got to insist on full and equal citizenship and participation and rights, and we can't ever give up.
Many of the young people who protested in Pittsburgh streets in the last year or so have been Pittsburgh public school students. Of course, you're on the school board now. Are you inspired by them?
I truly am. The students surprise me every day with their leadership, with their brilliance, with their integrity. When given the opportunity to fulfill their potential, they are amazing human beings, and I'm inspired every day that I'm around them.
Let's talk about that potential. That speaks to sort of a real-world education. What are you passionate about when it comes to what city kids can learn in the classroom?
I am most passionate currently. it evolves. About how we teach children to read. I think that I have I've been very unsatisfied with the school districts, the Pittsburgh school districts' failure to educate black and poor children in Pittsburgh. And I'm learning that a large part of that failure to educate has to do with the failure to teach them to read. If children are not competent readers by the end of the third grade, the likelihood is that they will not graduate from high school, they will not go to college, they will not earn a decent living, they will most likely end up in prison, or unfortunately end up prematurely dead. That's what's at stake. And if they are not successful in being able to read, they will not be successful in mathematics or science or other courses. Reading is the foundation of being able to excel in other scholastic endeavors, and we are not doing the best job we can do in teaching children how to read in preschool, in kindergarten, in first and second grade. Up until that point, we're teaching children how to learn to read. After the third grade, children are reading to learn. And if you haven't learned how to read by the end of the third grade, your chances for academic success are very, very in great jeopardy.
We have just a couple minutes left. So what's the answer? I mean, how do we teach them on a systemic, a district-wide level to learn to read by grade three so that they are then reading to learn, as you said?
Well, you first got to realize that what you're doing is not the most effective way. Then you've got to look around at other school districts around the country to see who has solved this problem. It has to do with whether or not we are teaching phonics and phonetic awareness, and we understand how the brain works and how child development learns how to read. If we do that, then they can learn, and if we don't do it, they'll pay a dear price.
So you were a city councilman for about a decade, I believe it was. Do you feel you've gotten more support as a school board member than maybe you did while you were on council?
No, it's about the same. the politics of city council and the politics of the school district are very similar. I get tremendous support from my constituents in the Hill District, in Garfield, and in Lawrenceville and Bloomfield, and throughout the city. I get a great deal of support, and I appreciate it.
In just a couple of sentences, what would your advice be for young African-American candidates today? Would you encourage them?
I would very much encourage full participation and insisting that the political systems that govern our lives do so with fairness and a democratic openness that allows us full participation, full citizenship. We have no other choice. We've got to fully participate and be successful in running candidates, in holding office, and using those offices to serve the people.
And your advice to these young candidates?
Do it.
Do it. Salah Uddin is a civil rights activist, former city councilman, and current member of the Pittsburgh Board of Education. Salah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Born on this day in 1941, Don Van Vliet was a bit of an enigma. Known by his stage name Captain Beefheart, Van Vliet was childhood friends with Frank Zappa, whose music feels downright pedestrian by comparison. The Captain Beefheart persona took shape in 1964, and along with a rotating cast of performers known as the Magic Band, it was subsequently dropped by a couple record labels before being signed to Zappa's Straight Records and releasing his most well-known work, Trout Mask Replica, in 1967. The album has been described as unlistenable, a joke, and, of course, a masterpiece. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One of the largest disc golf courses in the world will open this spring in Cranberry Township, Butler County. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports the project reflects a rapidly growing sport.
A skid steer has just fired up at North Boundary Park. It looks like a small tractor with a shovel on the front. It scoops up chunks of sandstone to cart across the hilly terrain.
These are all, like, what would you call them, odds and ends?
Course designer J. Gary Dropshow says the rock is left over from a project at a nearby quarry.
We've been puzzling together some of these structure to landscape parts of the course.
When it's finished, players will end up walking 4 miles to play all 18 holes.
Yeah, it's a workout. It's about
disc golf is sort of like regular golf. But instead of whacking a ball with a club, players take a few quick steps across the tee to build momentum as they throw a disc. Think of a frisbee, but smaller and heavier. Participants have to avoid trees as they try to get the disc to land in a metal basket. A round is generally free, though a disc costs about $15. The number of courses nationwide has tripled over the past decade as people realize it's a fun way to spend a few hours outside.
We see tons of deer running through here. We've seen hawks. We've seen turkey.
Pittsburgh area disc golfers consider Dropshow a legend. He's played for decades, designed multiple courses, and he's even in the Sports Hall of Fame in Appling, Georgia. He's seen the game change a lot since Pittsburgh's first course went in at Schenley Park in 1988. Discs didn't fly as far in those days, and players weren't as skilled.
The courses are trying to keep up. We are trying to stay ahead of them, but I'm predicting that the top players will come here and they'll probably shoot 10 under par. Even though this course is way bigger and longer than anything else we've done, they're just that good.
I hop in a cart with Drop Show's partner on the project. Doug Cloutier is an avid disc golfer who works for Cranberry Township. We go up a really steep climb that forces players to shoot uphill.
I calculated one time, I think it's a 25% slope.
We drive past the peak to hole 17 and walk toward the basket. It's elevated, so it's tricky to sink a putt. Cloutier doesn't want to miss and have his disc barrel down a drop-off on the other side.
Oh, no.
And it's down the hill.
Oh, no.
There it rolls.
That's what we refer to as a death putt.
The local disc golf community hopes a tough new course like this will attract major tournaments. They got a taste for the top level of play in 2015 when the World Championships took place at other courses nearby.
Excitement levels when the Worlds came was through the roof.
Lori Merriman chairs the nonprofit Pittsburgh Flying Disc.
We've had so many spectators come through just to see these top pros. Some of the spectators have never seen disc golf before, but you know, they see this event, let's go check it out. And then we had other just beginner players who came out to just see what a pro looks like on the course.
Participants stayed in Cranberry hotels, but the township itself didn't have a course. Officials took stock. They had a lot of undeveloped land at North Boundary alongside a water park, playground, and soccer fields. Then the Cranberry Township Community Chest jumped in to raise funds. Parks and Recreation Director Pete Geis says tourism is one benefit of creating a course.
It can definitely bring, you know, pretty significant money to our community. The direct impact for us, though, is just more people using our parks, you know, getting people outside, getting people on the trails.
Including a new trail that weaves around the baskets. Drop Show says the park will also feature six short ADA-accessible holes set aside from the rest.
For kids, for novices who've never played before, we don't want them coming out here and trying the championship course and throwing their disc off in the woods and losing it and thinking, ah, I hate this game. This is dumb.
As they get better, they can graduate to the longer course. Maybe they'll get hooked.
Nice.
And push this growing sport even further. Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As of December 1st, there was one fewer police department in Allegheny County. As the East Pittsburgh Police Department disbanded, state police began patrolling that community. But there are still more than 100 separate police departments serving different parts of Allegheny County. A trio of reporters at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette have been exploring those departments, how they differ, how they police. Shelley Bradbury, Chris Huffaker, and Ashley Murray, welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, as you suspected and confirmed through your reporting, not all police departments are created equal. In what ways? We'll start with you, Shelley.
Basically, in every way that you can think of. The kind of officer that comes to your house depends really on where you live. So some officers are high paid, some officers are low paid, some are full time, some are part time, some have 10 years of experience in your town, some have 6 months of experience in your town.
There's also huge variations in the sort of racial diversity or gender diversity that you're going to expect from your police department, depending on where you are. That's both a reflection of the town and just, you know, idiosyncrasies of who your chiefs are and who the county or town management is.
Ashley?
And there's also a big difference in what the police officers are making. So some are starting out very, you know, low salary, maybe $13.60 an hour for a part-time officer who's basically working just under full-time hours. And then some officers are making a salary of $70,000 plus a year.
Right. Well, let's get into each of those points that you raised. So municipalities with a smaller tax base, maybe a lower income population, I mean, it makes sense that the police department would be getting less funding and therefore offer lower paying salaries, right? I mean, if you don't have the money, if you're not collecting the tax revenues, that seems to be a logical conclusion.
It's actually kind of a reflection of the larger inequalities across the county. And it really does come back to tax base at the end. Like you said, when you're not collecting as much, then you're not able to pay as much. And then maybe you attract fewer applicants for the jobs. And then it's become sort of a cycle where you don't have the money to make a high quality of living. And that sort of reflects back on the police department.
Ashley, you're nodding your head.
Yes, yeah, some of the smaller municipalities in the eastern suburbs that I talked to said that there's just turnover. You know, you can't keep the same police officer for, you know, up to a year. You know, it's just a revolving door because there's not the benefits or the steady work or the higher pay offered.
Well, let me follow up with you, Ashley, and Chris and Shelley, if you want to chime in. So how does turnover impact the quality of policing?
Well, the police officers aren't knowing the community as well was one thing that I believe it was someone from North Braddock said to me. One of the council members from North Braddock told me. Yeah.
I mean, there's already the issue that police officers no longer live in the towns that they serve usually, and so they're having a harder time, you know, connecting with their communities. And at least if they're there a long time, they can build that connection over time. Whereas if they're in for 6 months and they're moving on to a different police department, they're not really getting to know anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Another part of that is that the officers who come in and just spend 6 months in a part-time job are typically at the very beginning of their career. They might have just come out of training, and they're just working to keep their state certification. So typically the officers that turn over quickly are also the least experienced officers, and they might make more mistakes or not serve the community as professionally as others.
I want to get to training. So we talked about maybe their first jobs or early jobs if they're part-timers, maybe looking to be on their way up. But what about training? Is it across the board training for all officers? Does it vary from department to department?
I believe pretty much all of them go to the same police academies before ending up at police departments. Only Pittsburgh and a couple other big ones can afford to send officers. So other places, they're going on their own and then applying for jobs. The big difference is in what sort of supplemental training they're able to get, because really small departments, they can't afford to let three people go do a supplemental training if they're only going to have four left to patrol the streets while those people are gone. Mm-hmm.
If the basic training by the state or the, however it's certified, is the same, so it's the supplemental, as you say, how you progress, how you continue to learn?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like, you might not be able to send anyone to like a detective training program or a SWAT program because you can't afford to lose them for even like a weekend or whatever.
That was a disadvantage I heard listed by some of the police chiefs that we reached out to. I mean, we reached out to basically every police chief in Allegheny County, and we would ask them, what are the advantages or disadvantages of the size of your department? And the smaller police departments that had less money would say, like, yes, we can't do as much specialized training.
So training for officers, follow-up training for officers. What about standards for police departments? Are there set standards?
No. There are no set standards for police departments across the state. There are accreditation programs that police departments can meet certain standards to be accredited, but there's no state guidelines that say you have to have five people, you have to have this much money. It's really up to each town to make those decisions.
Yeah, and as we saw in East Pittsburgh, even individual departments don't necessarily have their own standards that they're following. We didn't find any other places like East Pittsburgh that didn't have any sort of policy manual at all. But there was certainly variation in what level, how up to date, how detailed their requirements for themselves are.
The district attorney puts out a set of model policies that any police department in the county can adopt as their own policies, but the district attorney cannot force police departments to adopt those policies. It has to be a voluntary decision.
And so you can urge, you can recommend, but that's as much as you can do?
Yeah, it really comes down to the towns and the villages being independent governments that operate separately from the county and from the state.
Well, let me follow up on that. So we talked about pay and whether you can afford to pay officers a certain level, whether you can afford to send them for additional training. But if you have a model, sort of a template for policy, I mean, how much does that cost to actually to implement or at least to have a policy manual for your officers to follow?
Yeah, I think that kind of varies, like how much time is put into it and how up to date you keep it. One of the major problems that we heard from police departments that were more cash strapped is that they couldn't constantly update their policies. So larger departments can be more up to date on the newest procedures and standards. They can attend national conferences. They can hear from, they can bring in national experts. But the smaller departments can't do that. So some of them, if they have policy manuals, they're working off policy manuals that are 20 years old.
And you were mentioning East Pittsburgh did not have a policy per se when it came to pursuit and the subsequent shooting death of Antoine Rose.
I, if I recall correctly, they didn't have any policy manual at all. They had nothing.
They did not, yeah.
So, I want to ask you, is there a connection between crime rate and spending on police departments?
Yes. It's not a perfect correlation. There are things like if a town has a mall, that's going to mess up the numbers because there's going to be a lot of shoplifting. But we certainly saw, I mean, one of the problems with these cash-strapped places not having the resources to pay police, they're also the places that generally have the most crime and have the most need to deal with. And so there's this disconnect between the places that need a lot of resources for police and the places that have a lot of resources for police.
So are you saying that the best-trained officers, the best staff departments aren't in the communities that need them the most? Is that a fair conclusion, or did you find?
That's exactly right. Again, it's not universal, but that's very much what we found. There are places with big malls that are getting money from them to deal with stuff, but that's really the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, the poorer communities in general paid their police less and had higher turnover and typically less training, which isn't unexpected. But I think when we looked at it, we really saw some very stark differences. Like we have 2-person departments and then we have the 900-person department at Pittsburgh, and they're just very, very different places to work and places to be a police officer.
Or an example of Mount Lebanon, I think they had 46 officers. It's in the 40s, but yeah, it was like one of the more robust departments. I spoke to their police chief. They were sending their officers to training. Actually, I think he took my phone call from a training that he was at. But their 911 calls per capita, is lower than the other places that we looked at that were poorer.
Okay. So we talked about pay, talked about the training. What did you learn about disparities in racial and gender makeup of police forces?
It's pretty stark. There's really only a couple of places that appear to have really any substantial number of black or female officers on their forces. And they're actually the same places on both points. This is despite, you know, there's a dozen municipalities in the county that are majority or high percent African American. Mm-hmm. But Rankin is the only place with a majority black force. It's also got the highest percentage of women on the force. And it seems to really come down to, in large part, just who the chief is and what they seem to be pushing for.
Right. You talked to the Rankin chief, Ryan Wooten, is it?
Mm-hmm.
So how does he recruit?
Yeah, I mean, so Chief Wooten and Chief Coleman of Wilkinsburg, they're both black.
Yeah,
they're both black chiefs, and they have some of the highest numbers. They both talked about, I mean, they try to go to places people don't usually go to recruit. So instead of just like college campuses, they're going to churches and community events. I think they both also have some amount of benefit that they're visible people. And so if you're a young black police officer in the academy, you might know about them and want to go work for them. So to some extent, people come to them.
Mm-hmm. This has been, city of Pittsburgh has had an ongoing issue with minority and women representation on the forces for years and years. In fact, decades ago, a federal judge ordered the hiring of, in groups of four, one white male, one white female, one black male, one black female, just to try to get more gender diversity and racial diversity in it. So this is the exception to the rule is what's happening in Rankin and Wilkinsburg?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's true of Pittsburgh, and yet Pittsburgh performs better on those numbers than the county as a whole. It's over 10%, both black and women, and the county as a whole, all the police officers we got data on is, you know, 7 or 8%.
So we have various disparities. What are police departments looking at? Are they looking at all at mergers, at consolidations with neighboring communities? There have been a few consolidations over the years, but is there any move toward, and where might that be happening?
On December 7th, about 9 communities in the eastern suburbs of Allegheny County got together just to have a discussion. I may not remember all of them as I name them to you, and it will take up too much time. But it was, you know, East Pittsburgh just no longer has a police department, but their one of their community leaders led the meeting. Whitaker, North Braddock, Braddock Hills, those communities.
Right. I believe Rankin also, we mentioned Rankin, the chief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Rankin chief was present. So it was just a conversation to sort of maybe get the ball rolling on these ideas. There's also been discussions in the Fox Chapel School District, the municipalities within that school district.
So Fox Chapel, Aspinwall, Sharpsburg.
Yes. Yeah.
The Fox Chapel is no longer involved in the discussions.
Yes.
So, okay. So discussions, but any movement or, you know, what are stumbling blocks to consolidation of police forces?
There's a lot of pushback from community members on concern about losing identity. One of the community leaders that I spoke to in Ben Avon, who now has a contract with Ohio Township for police services, she said that there was concern and a worry about losing their community identity through their own police force at the beginning of the process. But now she said that it's like they have a... You know, they're a small municipality and they have the services of a large police force, which is Ohio Township.
Yeah, the identity issue came up a lot. People don't want cops from another place coming in and arresting their people. But also there's just a lot of practical difficulties. You have to merge salaries and pensions, and you have to get all your decals to match and get new patrol cars and figure out what buildings you're going to be in. So it's a very complicated process, and it's being handled by small town politicians who, for many of them, like the mayor runs the police force, and that is kind of his or her baby, if you will. They don't necessarily want to yield that power to another town.
All right. We have just about a minute left, so whoever wants to take this. So other than the state upgrading its required basic training for officers, are any changes basically up to the municipalities themselves because they're the ones that are funding them?
That's pretty much exactly it. There's some state funding and aid to looking at consolidation, but no one can make them do it. It's really their choice what they want to do with their police departments.
There are also some pushes at the state level to create more legislation to address some of these reforms.
Mm-hmm. And finally, what will each of you in a sentence or so be looking to follow up on? What do you still want to have answered?
I'm definitely waiting to hear more on what's happening in the Allegheny Valley consolidation, whether they get a support from the state and their look at consolidating.
I'd like to know how East Pittsburgh is doing without a police force.
The state police are patrolling,
mm-hmm.
right?
Correct.
And we'll be keeping an eye on the eastern suburbs and also those other municipalities we mentioned, and to see where those conversations go.
So if they go from conversations to actions?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Shelley Bradbury, Chris Huffaker, and Ashley Murray are Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporters whose series is called Patchwork Policing. Thanks so much to all of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, when you fill out your tax returns this year, it'll be more difficult to deduct charitable donations as a result of that tax law passed 13 months ago. What does this mean for you and for nonprofits? We'll speak with Pitt Law Professor Philip Hackney, who focuses on nonprofits and charities. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, plus Mick Stanelli, Joya Zenkovich, and Alex Lundigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.